Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big business opening today in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And it's not a Starbucks or a McDonald's, but a factory. A brand new Volkswagen factory with American workers to churn out cars made in America. After huge offshoring in the last decade and devastating losses in the economic meltdown, American manufacturing is enjoying more than an uptick. Some are calling it a renaissance. Rising wages in China and falling wages here have opened a window. But how good, how big, how long? This hour On Point, American manufacturing's comeback story. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? A manufacturing comeback? Do you believe it? Could we do it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Show us the money, Peter. We don't want happy talk here. What's the evidence?
You want the straight talk.
Straight talk.
The straight talk is that this is definitely positive, but to say that it's a renaissance is maybe going a step too far. I mean, I think what we're going to see is probably increase in the output of the manufacturing sector, that it will exceed the increase in the employment, because as higher productivity kicks in, companies will be able to make more with fewer workers. So we are, yes, we're seeing an uptick now in employment from its rock-bottom levels of a couple years ago. But there's very little chance that we're going to get back to the levels of even the beginning of the last decade. January 2001, we had 17 million people employed in manufacturing. By the depths of the recession, we were down to just over 11. Well, now we're up to 11.7. You know, we're still only inching our way back from the bottom of the pit.
250,000 manufacturing jobs, since the beginning of last year, I guess, and we'll take them. I mean, in this economy, especially in hard-hit parts, a job is a blessing, and we'll take it. For the first time, I'm reading here, Peter, we're creating more jobs in manufacturing than we're eliminating. For the first time in a decade, that's a kind of good news.
For sure, for sure. It's good news. I visited a General Electric plant in Greenville, South Carolina, a few weeks ago for an article in Bloomberg Businessweek. And I was actually impressed by what they're doing there. They've realized that the low-tech, low-skilled jobs are not the future of manufacturing, that if you're going to keep manufacturing jobs in this country, they've got to be people really empowered to make decisions on their own, to use their heads. And they were teaching these people who were, you know, high school grads, not college grads, you know, statistical process control and how to use five-axis numerically controlled machines. Pretty heavy-duty stuff, and it was impressive to see the democracy on the shop floor there.
Now, democracy because it's not a union floor. What about union status?
That's a good question, but I talked to the plant manager, plant leader, they call him, and about democracy at the GE plant, and he said, well, he's worked in union shops too, and they're working on the same sorts of things there. Have to be tailored a little bit here and there for union work rules, but you know, union workers want the same things. They also want to be able to be given credit for being able to use initiative and creativity.
So here's GM announcing that it's going to add 4,000 jobs at 17 American plants just a week or two ago. I mean, we're reading about, you know, Whammo is opening, bringing back to the United States production of Frisbees and hula hoops.
Well, that's essential, right?
It's manufacturing. but then we mentioned this Volkswagen opening today in Chattanooga, and they've got big plans for that. Going to make the Passat sedan there, but they're going to pay their starting wages $27 an hour. That is roughly, that's wages and benefits, very important to note, but that's about half of the $52 an hour cost of labor at the Detroit 3 these days. What about wages at this return or revived manufacturing?
The little bit of the dark side of this here is that one of the reasons the U.S. is getting more competitive is that relative pay is falling. You know, you mentioned in your intro that Chinese wages are rising, and that's 17% a year. What we're kind of saying is, yes, we can compete with the Chinese as long as we're poorer and they're richer. So it's a mixed blessing.
And of course, $27 an hour fully loaded is at the better end of what we're seeing in some of this comeback manufacturing.
Right. There's a lot of jobs. I don't think those WAMO jobs are going to be paying $27 an hour.
Does this mean that offshoring is over? I mean, that's what really drained the pond in the last decade, right? That huge fall off after 2000.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was jobs that was going to China. Is that still happening or is that changing?
Well, I think it's still happening, maybe just at a reduced pace. For every incident you hear of job being repatriated to the U.S., there are a lot of jobs that are not being trumpeted quite so loudly that are still going overseas.
So is this, in the end, a big deal for the American economy, or is this just a ripple?
Essential for this to happen because we are running an enormous trade deficit. It's unlikely that we can recoup it all in services, so that leaves production of real goods and services. It doesn't have to be all manufactured products. Some of it could be natural resources, but we've got to produce stuff the rest of the world wants. It may happen through a cheapening of the dollar, and that's sort of the negative way for this to work out. But one way or another, we can't keep running these huge deficits to the rest of the world and building up a debt to other countries.
So we've got it, and it's coming back or growing here. 9% growth in the first quarter this year compared to 1.8% for the economy overall. You've got to call it a bright spot, even if it's headed back to where it was.
Yeah, I don't want to be too much of a downer here. I think this is a good thing, and if we can train our workers, if people can get excited about working in this field, which could be a fascinating work, actually, it could actually be a real positive for the economy, not just in the current rebound from the recession, but for years to come.
Hey, Peter, take us to that factory in Greenville, South Carolina, to give us a sense of this high-end manufacturing you're talking about. That was really interesting.
What they make there is the turbine blades for jet engines.
Mm-hmm.
These are kind of dinky things. They look like shark's teeth, about 3 inches long, with like 300 teeny tiny holes, some of them thinner than human hair. And what they do, their job is to take the raw piece of metal and drill the holes in it using these computer numerically controlled machine tools, which move them around, and it's all programmed in ahead of time. Their job is just to oversee the machines, make sure they're working correctly, look for deviations from the norm, and they're actually empowered, this is the impressive thing to me, to set up the line as they see fit. And the plant leader will actually pay for them to set it up the way they want, as long as they're meeting the quality standards that they're required to meet.
300 holes in each little blade, and this is high engineering, to spread a coat of cool air over the spinning blades so they aren't melted, you report to us, by those 300,000-degree exhaust gases there. That's the high end. Is the high end most of what's growing again, Peter, or not?
Yeah, that's where we're going to be seeing the growth. Companies like Boeing, complicated machine tools. The U.S. still excels in making, certain computers, although, of course, a lot of that's gone away, too. Auto manufacturing is a very high-tech field. Let's not undermine that. As you mentioned, the VW plant in Chattanooga. So we're not going to compete with the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, or rural China in low-tech manufacturing, but we hope, still compete in the more high-tech end of the spectrum.
And not just hula hoops, though we're happy to have that come home, too. Peter Coy with Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks very much for being with us, Peter.
Thank you.
Let me turn now to Philadelphia and Thomas Runowitz. He joins us there. He's an economist with the U.S. industry practice of IHS Global Insight. Thomas Runowitz, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
This all got kicked off when the Boston Consulting Group, I guess, put out a report. Maybe you guys have too, but they were talking about a renaissance in American manufacturing in the next 5 years. They're saying they expect net labor costs for manufacturing in China and the U.S. to converge around 2015. I don't know if that's good news or not. Do you believe it? And is it good news?
Well, I think Peter was pretty well on target when he says it may be an overstep to say it is a renaissance. What I'd like to say is, and it's kind of an analogy here, that the manufacturing sector is in recovery, but it has not recovered from this recession that we've seen. This recession was very devastating. It was the largest drop we've seen in the post-war era. And I'll give you a prime example. Even in 2009, manufacturing sector on an output volume basis declined over 13%. I mean, that was huge decline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what we've seen is some significant growth since then. Last year, it grew almost 6%, and this year we're looking for about another 7% growth. However, though, when you're looking on a volume basis, okay, we're still not at the levels where we were before this recession occurred.
Volume of output or volume of jobs? What does that mean, Tom?
Volume of output, and also the jobs, too. Now, while we look for the volume of output to increase over the next couple of years and eventually exceed what we saw in 2007 before this recession by 2013, the jobs lost during this recession, even though we're starting to see some increase, all the jobs lost during a recession in manufacturing are not going to come back. It's too much of a step down. And what we're seeing is small increases in employment on the manufacturing side, but the total loss that we've seen over the past couple of years will not be gained.
We're trying to get our head around this. I mean, a lot of people like you are calling this the shining star of the recovery, sort of the premier growth sector in the recovery, and yet we're not talking about getting back to 2007 or 2009. That's a step forward, a step point two back.
Well, we're not. What it is a shining star in terms of volume and output, and what it is, what I'm referring to is the growth level relative to the rest of the economy. Rest of the economy, we're looking for about a 2.7% growth this year. Manufacturing is 7%. So what you're seeing is a lot of the support of the U.S. economy are being occurred in or being supported by the manufacturing side. So in there, it is the shining star.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the buzz of a comeback in American manufacturing. What that comeback is and what it isn't, so far anyway, sounds like an oxymoron, but it is happening, maybe in places that you might not have expected to happen, including this whole country after what we saw in the last decade of downsizing and offshoring. We've been joined by Thomas Runowitz with IHS Global Insight in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. With us right now as well is Susan Helper, economics professor at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. Susan Helper, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're there in manufacturing territory. What do you make of the talk of the comeback? I mean, we had 14% unemployment in Michigan not long ago. Now it's 10%. That's still high, but it's a lot better than 14. Is manufacturing kicking in here, Susan?
Yeah, I think we are seeing a little bit of growth, and we see the potential for some more growth with the rise in Chinese wages, the rise in fuel costs that makes it expensive to ship stuff a long way. So I think there's potential. I think there's a couple things that we ought to be doing to make these jobs jobs that we really want, and jobs that support the middle class that has been strong in America. And so I think there's two things. One, I think, is actually relatively simple, or sounds simple, and that is to kind of change accounting and think about how we make these production decisions. That the BCG report focuses on labor cost. Even they say labor cost is 20 to 30%. I think it's more like 10 to 20% in most manufacturing direct labor. The rest of it is purchasing, it's top management time, it's inventory management.
So you're saying that even if wages were much, much cheaper in China, it's just 10 to 20% of the ultimate cost of the good. Therefore, don't just chase those wages so quickly. But everybody did.
Yes. And I think one of the things that we're finding is that, you know, they thought they were going to make these huge profits. You know, if wages fall from $14 an hour to a dollar, gee, ought to be, you know, raking it in. And I think what they saw was, gee, you know, every time you debug something, you know, if you have to send an engineer to China, it could be, you know, $10,000 just for the airfare. You have your top management that's thinking about resolving, you know, problems in some widget supplier in the middle of nowhere in China rather than thinking about, you know, what's the new product line that we should be developing. So I think there's been a beginning of a reevaluation. I think the BCG report, there's also an Accenture report, are very important in getting companies to think a little bit more clearly about their costs. And just the kicker on this is, you know, sometimes when an engineer did get sent over from China, it'd be the U.S. plant that was charged for the expense of doing that because they were an employee of that plant. So there's a lot of, you know, so when you offshore, there's one easily measured cost that falls dramatically. That's direct labor. There's a bunch of other costs that rise, and these are either spread across budgets or they're not captured at all, like the cost of top management time. Yep. So I think that's the first thing that we need to do, is just really reevaluate how we source these products.
See it as a little more complicated than just those lower wages abroad. Thomas Renowitz, what else goes into this change or turn that we're seeing some amount of now? What about currency? What about, I don't know, supply chain? What's bringing home? What's coming home?
Very good. In fact, I think Peter mentioned this too. It's one of the big advantages we have is the big fall of the dollar that we've seen. In fact, against our major trading partners, since 2005, the dollar is over 17% lower than it was before. So in that sense, there's twofold. Number one, of course, it's a competitive advantage. It makes our exports and our goods, materials and so on, more attractive abroad. But it also, puts a little damper on import penetration, importing either steel or metals or chemicals or plastics or whatever. That makes it more expensive to import. So rather than many purchasers of those products buying from foreign producers, they may well support buy those domestically sourced here.
Right.
And that has been a real nice advantage in the United States that we've seen is this decline in the dollar. The other thing is, too, is this whole idea of the production process that we've seen. The manufacturing side has really gone through a big change. This recession that we've had has been a big shock, and they've had to gone through a lot of processes in how they manufacture, looking at being very competitive on a global basis. So the production facilities that we're seeing now and the investment that we're seeing occurring in this recovery that we're seeing out of the recession is that the whole process has become a lot more either capital intensive or mechanized. And in other words, we're seeing productivity start to increase tremendously. And what we're seeing on this productivity end is the capital intensive and the high tech investment that we're seeing within the whole production process. And the skill source that's being required in these factories, in these sectors, is a lot higher than it would be normally on a lower end and a lower scale. So the source of education and the high skill source that we have in the United States is one of the factors that people, when they produce a plant, saying, wait a minute, I have this very technical process now, I have a lot of robotics, I have a lot of computers, I need chemical analysts and so on in the production process.
Right.
I need the skill set. Where am I going to find that? I'm not going to find that either. It may be more difficult in India. It may be more difficult in Vietnam. China's upgraded. But somewhere else, here in the United States, we have a very good skill set to support this new whole production process that we're seeing in the manufacturing sector. So that's one of the decisions also.
Listen, that's fantastic to hear. That is fantastic to hear, and our listeners are responding. I mean, you just talk about a comeback in American manufacturing, and people, there is skepticism, but there's also real, like, oh my gosh, here on Facebook, Carol says, let's hope so. Robert says, praise the Lord. But here's a question for you, Susan. Doreen says, I certainly hope that the jobs created are livable wage jobs where workers have protections, collective bargaining rights against predatory employers. Otherwise, it's still a race to the bottom. When these jobs are created here in the United States, what about that? I mean, there's still that arbitrage, that global arbitrage in labor rates. Susan, is it still a race to the bottom even when the jobs are here in the United States?
I think there's a potential for that to happen, and I think we're seeing that. And so I think as a nation, we need to think about which of sort of two strategies we want to adopt. There's what's called a high road strategy, where you have these highly paid workers, highly skilled, doing the kind of work that Peter Coy described, making really good, sophisticated products and profits for employers. There's another possibility of very low-wage work, where you see people doing a lot of hand labor, not a lot of knowledge provided. And I think that we want to encourage this high road, pave the high road, block the low road, is what people say. You can do that, I think, first by I think there's a need for training, not just of workers, but also of employers. I'm doing a survey for the U.S. Department of Labor, the auto supply chain, of second and third tier suppliers, so smaller companies.
Okay.
Only half of them have these quality circles where they're achieving, getting input from their workers. Half, you know, some of them do, about 5 to 10% have 100% of their workers participating in these things. So it's possible. And what we need to do is increase the percentage of firms that act in this democratized manner, and that has a lot of social benefits that are not entirely captured by the firm, whereas this low road, often you end up with employees using Medicaid, other social services, because they're not paid enough to have a living wage. So I think that, you know, both policy by companies, as I suggested with the accounting system, and by the public policy are really important to push this opportunity in a way that strengthens the middle class rather than undermines it, as the writer suggests.
Susan, stand by there in Cleveland, if you would, and Thomas Runowitz in Philadelphia. Joining us right now from North Canton, Ohio, is Ben Suarez, founder and chief executive of Suarez Corporation Industries. He is hiring in a pretty big way. Projections that he will hire 2,500 workers over the next 18 months there. And just in this last week, people lining up to apply for those jobs to manufacture in the United States. Ben Suarez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what are you making, and who are you hiring?
Well, we have a home appliance line called Eden Pure. And one of the products is a portable heater, but it's not a typical portable heater. It's a complicated portable heater, so it takes a lot of man hours to produce. And the particular product is highly dependent on what the sales are dependent on the weather. The colder it gets, the more heaters we sell.
Right.
Because the heater not only heats, but it also saves energy. It produces heat for 30% less, and it also, you can turn the temperature down in the rest of your house and
just heat that room.
One room.
Right.
And,
so you've made these in China, and now you're bringing them home. Is that part of the reason why? So you can respond to demand, a cold snap, and boom, you can crank up production and have them in the stores?
That was the initial reason. We were getting murdered because in our forecasting, you try to predict the weather, which is impossible.
Yeah,
in long
right.
range. And you know, if the weather would get cold, and it would come at a time when we weren't predicting it, we would get slammed, we'd be out of inventory, and it was costing us a lot of money. If we over-ordered, it would tie up capital. So we try to have products sourced in this country. Every product that we want to manufacture, we first try here. And, of course, everybody, you know, would want to produce here for, you know, the reasons that your other guests have said. It's a very high skill level. It's you don't have to ship it from overseas. If you ship it from overseas, it takes a month to do the order, plus another month in transit.
And when it's got that Made in America label on it, does it sell better?
We didn't know this, but we started manufacturing some about 10% of the products last fall, and we're finding out that the Made in the USA increases the sales 30%.
Now, let me ask you, though, on the pay side, I mean, you've got people lining up there. You're talking about 2,500 workers to be hired maybe over the next 18 months, I think, into an old Hoover vacuum plant there in North Canton, which I think is your hometown. But where they paid around $20 an hour, you will be paying for assembly of those space heaters, I'm reading here in the Washington Post, $7.50 to $8.50 an hour. In some states, that's minimum wage. It's not exactly hallelujah.
That was an error. That is not correct. The starting jobs pay $7.50 to $14 an hour.
Okay.
And also, we're a profit-sharing company. We give half of our profits to our employees, which averaged per employee over the past 10 years about $22,500.
But that profit-sharing does not go to factory workers who are contract employees, which is a lot of people in your factories, as I'm reading here anyway.
That was correct, but we are going to also change that so that they are going to benefit from profit sharing.
I guess my question is, when you're paying 7 to 14 for starting workers there, you know, when we hear manufacturing coming, growing in the United States, Mr. Suarez, we think, you know, hallelujah, the middle-class lifestyle is back. But we all know $7 is not a middle-class lifestyle or anything close to it. Even 14 is kind of tough. I mean, do you think Americans should think, you know, nice middle-class lifestyle when they think manufacturing these days? Or do they have to think low-end, just lucky to have a job, lucky that it's here and not in China?
Well, first of all, those are the prices for just assembly work. We produce also 99% of the products or the parts in this country. Now, the parts makers are much higher skill, so they pay more. So it isn't that simple. Secondly, if we have to pay a certain wage higher in those particular jobs, then first of all, our customers couldn't afford the product, and then you have to compete in the marketplace, so there wouldn't be a job to begin with, or a business for that matter.
So, I mean, the message for American workers in manufacturing, what do you think it is? You can look there for a happy home or not. It's you're still in competition wage-wise with the whole world.
That's the hard reality. If I don't know of any CEO wouldn't want to pay their workers $100 an hour and they would all be prosperous. But the reality is you can't do that and be in business because your competitors aren't going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be on the store shelves of somebody that's not going to do that. So you've got to figure out ways to make your product price competitive.
What's the turnout been there in North Canton, Ohio for these jobs? Have you had a good turnout of people looking for the jobs?
Well, for the initial 110 jobs, there was 1,000 people that showed up.
Wow.
And it's really a sad situation. I mean, I was a poor kid, and I worked my way through college, and I came from a blue-collar family, and I had to work two jobs, a steel mill and as a meat cutter, and I was laid off a lot. And I can feel for those people because I've been there, but... Also, I have a business to run. I'm responsible for many jobs and many families, and I've got to deal with the realities of it.
And the reality is, it's a job. It may not pay what it paid in the Hoover days, but it's a job, and it's there in North Canton. Ben Suarez, CEO of Suarez Corporation Industries, thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Suarez.
You're welcome.
Susan Helper, there it is. I mean, the direct case in point. Of course, there's a higher end and higher paid as well, but he's bringing it home. It's not paying great.
Well, I wonder. So Mr. Suarez is actually almost my neighbor there in North Canton. I'm in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm, right.
I wonder if there's a way of increasing the productivity, increasing the value of those jobs. And I'd be happy to come talk to him and happy to, bring – there's a lot of services in Magnet, the Manufacturing Extension Program. The state of Ohio has a number of programs that might be able to help. Maybe it's not possible to automate or to add value into those jobs, but there might be. And, I applaud Mr. Suarez for the beginning of this. And what I hope is that this can be a ramp up to a very stable and higher wage employment for a large number of people. And I think it's really great that he's moved to make more of his employees available, eligible for that profit sharing.
Thomas Runnerwitz, we just got a couple seconds before the break here, but do you see a ramp in manufacturing like that or a slide down in wages?
Well, it depends. As it was discussed, those mm-hmm. that are on the more technical end, the more skilled set, are also going to generate the higher wages and the higher levels. Those that are in the lower skill, all right, or unskilled labor, those jobs are always going to be very difficult to find in manufacturing and very difficult to live on. And you cannot really compete on those lower scale, lower skilled against the rest of the world. That's where the competitive advantage is lost. The highly skilled levels, where the higher paid ones, are where we have the competitive advantage here in manufacturing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the buzz of a comeback in American manufacturing, looking at what that comeback is and what it isn't. though people very plainly happy to have those jobs. And as Susan Helper with us from Case Western University's Weatherhead School of Management says, pave the high road and look for those high-paying jobs. That's the way to real success here. Thomas Runowitz with us as well from IHS Global Insight in Philadelphia. And we're looking at exactly what's going on here. Boston Consulting Group report that got all this going talks about a renaissance in manufacturing in this country over the next 5 years as the wage gap with China shrinks. 69% growth in wages there in recent years, 17% a year those wages are going up. Of course, they're still far below American. Certain U.S. states becoming some of what they call the cheapest locations for manufacturing in the developed world. And they're pointing particularly at Mississippi, South Carolina, Alabama, increasingly competitive as low-cost bases for supplying the U.S. market. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and William. William, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
Well, I'm down here. I'm on the steering committee for the German Chamber for Tennessee. I'm also an attorney down here, and my law.
The German Chamber, like as in the German Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
Okay.
The German
yep.
Chamber in Tennessee, which
All right.
has been actively involved vis-a-vis the Chattanooga plant, which, of course, is a German company, VW.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've seen down here is there's been quite a bit of growth in manufacturing and in automotive in Tennessee and the surrounding states. And I see a lot of attrition from the north to the south, actually, because the cost of living is lower down here, the cost of property is lower down here, it's a right-to-work state down here,
right.
the union issues aren't as much, but some of that's controversial. And so I've seen it more regional in terms of the movement of jobs, with there being diminishment in some of the northern states where costs are higher and wages are higher, and growth down in the south.
Now, that is interesting. How do you feel about that? On the one hand, you're a southerner. On the other hand, you're an American. How do you feel about if indeed manufacturing jobs are, chasing the lower wage within this country, as obviously they are, what do you think of that?
Well, I'd rather see it here than other
yeah.
countries.
Yeah.
I've actually seen plants closing down in Mexico and coming back to the south for just some of the reasons you all discussed about China. Even though there's not the same distance as there is to China, there are issues with labor there, there are issues with transportation, crossing international borders and so forth that we just don't have here. And the workforce, the educational programs that are being put into effect have really helped as well. So I would rather see the jobs stay in America and perhaps higher tech, more expensive, better paying jobs be developed for those folks in areas where the cost of living is higher, if they can find them.
Yep. I appreciate your call, William. Thomas Runowitz, how about it? Is it should we be cheering that we're talking about, sporting some of the cheapest locations for manufacturing in the developed world? Of course, people are cheering in Chattanooga today. There's a VW plant opening there, and it's opening in part because they can compete handsomely in that Tennessee location with some more northerly American auto plants.
Yeah, in fact, when you're talking about Volkswagen, and in fact, Germany has one of the highest labor costs around. So obviously, you can see the competitive advantage there that we've gained. We've gained a production facility versus producing it somewhere else, especially like in Germany. But when you look at it overall, indeed, that the U.S. is very competitive internationally, and we do supply a lot of the export market in terms of a lot of high-end products when you're looking at construction equipment, when you're looking at farm machinery, all types of industrial equipment. We have a niche here that a lot of the production that we do here is exported and it is domestically produced. So in a sense, though, the U.S. is really still quite strong in a number of areas when you're looking at the manufacturing sector and being competitive internationally.
Of course, being strong felt good when there were 17 million in manufacturing, and 11 million in manufacturing doesn't feel as good. Eduardo writes here, Susan, America should follow the example of Germany and aspire to become a manufacturer of high skill. You say pave the high road, block the low road. I'm not sure how that's going to go down in the South where they're getting a bunch of those lower wage jobs. Can we be a successful German-style manufacturer on a mass scale in a way that supports mass high-wage unemployment in this country? Can we be that again, Susan?
I think we can if we have the will. And I think a first step is to change some of these public policies that actually subsidize the low road.
Like what?
For example, we allow a lot of competition across states. So there's a high-wage employer here in Cleveland that is being undercut by another state that's paying a foreign manufacturer, basically building them a free plant. And so, you know, we all lose in that way. The taxpayers end up providing money to businesses, and the wages are lower often in these new plants.
But if they don't build it across that American state border, maybe it just goes across an international border. I mean, we've signed into NAFTA. You know,
right.
If it doesn't go a little bit south, maybe it goes way south.
Right. No, and that's the second issue around trade agreements, that trade agreements have a lot of protections for intellectual property. They're not, you know, just, quote, free trade agreements. If they were, they wouldn't be 2,000 pages long. They have a lot of protections for intellectual property, but very few protections for labor rights or environmental rights. And so it encourages or facilitates this race to the bottom that you've described.
But we have the sense that those are done deals. They've been drafted and crafted and signed, and they're done. Are you saying that to get on a German-style high road path, we have to renegotiate those agreements?
It would help. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, I think Germany until just recently was the largest exporter in the world. It only recently passed by China, which has a far larger population. So what Germany does is not just the kind of problem-solving skill on the shop floor, but also deep apprenticeships and deep skill in welding, et cetera, that almost everyone on a shop floor would have had a multi-year training program while they're in high school. And then also on top of that, there's training for small manufacturers, that they're not left alone to sort of try to figure out what the latest strategy is. There's a lot of university, industry, employer association, union partnerships that help these small companies stay current with the latest technology. Because, you know, I think we have this idea that there's something called a low-wage, low-skill job or low-wage industry. And I think that's not necessarily the case, that you can add skill to almost any job. And the way for us to compete with China is not by trying to do the job in the same way, but to automate, add skill, et cetera.
Thomas Ranowitz, let me ask you about that, because in a way, this seems to be really, really the nub of it. I mean, we can compete on wages, and I guess within the developing world, if this recent report is right, we are now, you know, some of the lowest wages in the developing world. But that's not, you know, on the one hand, it's jobs. On the other hand, you don't want to crow about that too much. Is there a way for the United States to become a German-style manufacturer, that kind of, you know, high productivity, high-end, mass employment? Within the German scale, it's mass. Is that achievable here?
We are slowly becoming that way. In fact, our outlook on the low end, the unskilled manufacturing really worker is going to be, when you look at it over the long term, is really going to be very small product part of overall manufacturing. In fact, the job market for an unskilled manufacturing worker is probably going to be very, very difficult to find any type of work anywhere. Any time in manufacturing now as we go forward, really looking over the next, even in the long term, it's going to be the high-tech, skilled manufacturing worker, a technician, an engineer, either a chemist or somewhere. The skill set and the amount of knowledge that's required in our manufacturing process to be competitive is going to require that worker. And that is where the productivity gains are that we can achieve to be competitive on manufacturing on an international basis.
Let's go to Joanne in Buffalo, New York. Joanne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a great conversation. And I'm calling from Buffalo, New York, the poster child for the loss of manufacturing jobs.
Sadly, yes. But do you see some comeback there? Any sign of it, Joanne? Do you pay attention to that?
I can't say that I do, but, you know, listening to this conversation, you know, perhaps there are things brewing, and I'm going to make sure that I keep my my eyes open.
Yep.
and to see. But I wanted to make a couple of comments.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I worry when we start to talk about guaranteeing middle wage or middle class wages when we're talking about low skilled jobs, and all of a sudden we're talking about collective bargaining, and of course, you know, living in New York State, we have an inordinate power base here for public employees.
But we're not talking the Registry of Motor Vehicles. We're talking with manufacturing. Do you think we can see that kind of...
Here is my point. I don't think that we should demand that that lower skill wages be increased just on the basis of trying to guarantee a middle class income or lifestyle. this might be an opportunity, on the other hand, for the government to come in and subsidize a situation like that with a sort of universal health care plan. So if we have workers that are making the minimum wage for the work that they're doing,
right,
they, of course, also need health care, but, of course, the manufacturer can't afford that because then the product is no longer profitable. Could the government then come in and do something pragmatic and innovative and support a company, a company's workers?
Pragmatic, innovative, and maybe a little bit German style. I'm not sure about that, but let us ask. Susan Helper, there was a time not long ago when we were told, you know, American auto manufacturers can't be competitive because of American health care costs. What about? I mean, I think that's a good question by Joanne. Are there, you know, is health care, for one, still a big deal here in the cost of manufacturing in this country? Could we structure American health care so that we would advantage American manufacturers just on the basis of that?
I think it is a big issue. Some of the restructuring in the auto industry has changed things, but there is more health care embodied in a cost of a car than there is steel. And Toyota recently built a plant in Canada rather than the U.S. because of the universal health care system they have there. And if you're and this is another way, I think, in which we undercut our high road employers, in that if you're an employer and offer health care to your workers, you end up subsidizing not only them but also the uninsured. And so your competitor down the street who doesn't offer health care and their employee gets hurt and goes to an emergency room, you know, on the job or off the job, you know, that high road employer is paying for that. So I think what the caller suggests would actually help quite a lot.
Does the health care reform that was recently passed under President Obama, does it help on this front or not?
I think it does, in that it's going to get more people into the pool, including more young, healthy people, lowering the cost for all. It has a number of mechanisms for cost control in it, a number of particularly prevention. If you know you're going to have health care, if health care providers know that they're going to have the same person in their system for a long time, there's an incentive to do a lot of preventive care that saves money over the long term.
So maybe,
know, it's a very complex system. So I think it actually is a step forward.
Let's take a call from Ashburnham, Massachusetts. And Will, hi, Will, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think you're missing two very important things. As far as wages go, first, I've worked in manufacturing, and manufacturing allows people who have a strong work ethic to kind of climb up the corporate ladder, and maybe you'll start making minimum wage, but you can very easily, as long as you have the work ethic and the intelligence, you can climb up to, you know, a higher position. I personally know people who have started as maintenance mechanics or
right,
machine operators and
yep,
are now in high management.
Yeah, good for them.
Also, as far as China goes, not only are wages cheaper, but China not floating their currency gives them an unfair advantage in the market, and I think that's even more important than their low wages, and we need to enforce our trade agreements, because when China joined the WTO, they're supposed to float their currency, and they still haven't. So I think that's one thing that, as far as the government could do to aid manufacturing and American jobs.
Will, let us pick those up, and I appreciate your call. Thomas Renowitz, what about on the currency front here? You point out the U.S. currency is not as strong as it was, and that's helping, but China tends to sort of draft along behind the dollar there and not really let it float too much. Could we see even bigger changes in relative currency values that would dramatically further advantage American manufacturers? Is that in the offing, Tom, or not?
Well, it's a policy issue with China. Of course, they're very restrictive with their I was going to say their exchange.
Mm-hmm.
What I've read and what I understand is they're into not so much in floating, but very small changes or small adjustments in their currency relative to the United States.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's one of the reasons also that China's been able to export so much, of course, is because their currency is basically almost artificially adjusted.
Pegged behind the dollar. Do we have the leverage to change that, or is there anything structurally from their side that might change that?
Well, I think most of it is political and policy changes, but also China's pretty much of a big player now, and what they've been able to do, they've been able to continue. There's been pressure, like I said, for them to adjust their currency, and of course, what you'll see is you'll see small adjustments. And I think what the Chinese policy is definitely to make it evolve over time rather than any major changes over the next couple of years.
What do you see grand scale for the American economy and how much manufacturing can do for it? We heard so much about the service economy in the last 10, 15 years. Now there's more manufacturing, but it's also growing in a lot of emerging economies. People want to manufacture near where demand is, and demand is growing very quickly there, and that's not in the United States. So do you see this as a major life preserver for employment and economic growth in this country, Tom, or not?
Well, in terms of employment, no. Okay, we're going to see some small growth in employment and manufacturing. Not a lot. I mean, you're talking probably maybe 200,000 jobs this year, 250, mm-hmm. maybe another 200, 250 next year. You're not going to see big resurgence in employment and manufacturing. Where the growth is, what we're recovering here is on the production side and the volume side. In other words, we are seeing some stronger, much stronger growth there than we are on the employment and manufacturing.
Susan Helper, we just got 20 seconds. Do you agree? Can we be bailed out by manufacturing, or are we talking at the margins here?
I think manufacturing can play an important role. It can't do it all by itself in recovering the American middle class and the economy.
Well, there's what it is and what it isn't, at least as of today. For those who are finding those jobs and finding a path up, congratulations. We're glad for you. For the whole country, a lot to think about right there about what it means for jobs in our economy long term, just how much it can be. Susan Helper at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Thank you for joining us, Susan.
Thank you.
And Thomas Runowitz at IHS Global Insight. Thanks, Tom.
Sure, thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.